What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it, stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
To talk about the Hall of Fame, someone who had the opportunity to cover all three players at one time, Dave Lennon from Newsday. Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm still just wondering who you were talking about with the critical and negative stuff. I mean, that just seems that just seems so out of left field for this particular market. I don't know where you came up with that.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Definitely not Boston, Philly, New York. We're not critical at all.
You got the whole Eastern Seaboard there. That pretty much covers it.
Yeah, but you know, we get it's easy in the day to day, and baseball is such a game of failure that most of the time, whatever you're doing. And I think when we see these athletes who are so big and strong and have the ability to so regularly these days throw 97, 98 miles an hour and hit a ball 400 feet with, you know, exit velo of 100 miles an hour and all of this, that we expect the, you know, the success to be to happen all the time. And I think sometimes we lose perspective on appreciating a Hall of Fame career, even as it plays out before our eyes. We watched it today, CeCe Sabathia, Billy Wagner, Ichiro, all being inducted. And I wanted to start with CeCe. And you obviously have been someone who has covered the Yankees and Mets as a beat writer and as a columnist with both teams now for quite some time. So with CeCe Sabathia, let's start with before he was traded to the Yankees, as someone who covered the league, what was your impression, just even from afar, of what he did to lift the Brewers to the postseason back in 2008 when he was a penned, you know, he gets traded to the Brewers, makes 17 starts, 7 complete games, 3 on short rest, and he's about to be a free agent. And this guy does that.
You left out the 3 shutouts out of those 7 complete games. I mean, yeah, it was, I think that the thing that strikes me about Sabathia, and I did, and something that I wrote just today in talking about how few innings that starters pitch in relative to a team's total innings these days, that it's ironic that CeCe was being honored today and inducted into the Hall of Fame as the guy that was the prototypical ace that people wanted to trade for, mm-hmm. and was perhaps the greatest deadline ace acquisition that baseball has ever seen, or at least near the top of that list.
Sure.
For what you just mentioned. I mean, going his record during that time, I think his ERA was 2 and change. I think he averaged over 7 innings in those starts in that second half, too. So
hang on, I have the numbers for you. He had a 1.65 ERA over those 17 starts, and a whip that was 1.003 whip, but a 1.65 ERA, 17 starts, 7 complete games, 3 of those on, you know, 3 shutouts, 3 on short rest, and just knowing that he was about to be a free agent, when we talk about the things today, if we talk about, I think of David Peterson maybe as the Mets bulldog, quote unquote. He's a guy who, you know, looks like, oh, he's going to take the ball every fifth day and he's going to give you 6 or 7 innings. And that's the definition of a bulldog these days. But
CeCe was a guy, like you mentioned, is a guy that just would, once you gave him the ball, he didn't want to give it back.
Yeah.
You know, until the game was over. And I think that's the difference. You know, I mean, it's just a different definition these days. And CeCe was remiss as he got later in his career towards the end that he couldn't do that anymore. You know, that was, I think that was the hardest thing for him. I mean, he did lose velocity, obviously. He couldn't be the same kind of pitcher. He had to lean more on his breaking stuff, which, you know, was always exceptional anyway. He was hardly a fastball pitcher, always a fastball pitcher, although he had a dominant fastball. So I think that's what really was the hardest thing for him down the end, is that he couldn't take the ball on his days to pitch and have the capability to just go to the end, you know, and walk off the mound finishing it. And that speaks to the kind of pitcher that he was. I mean, we don't see guys like that anymore. And I think that's kind of like the biggest tribute when you see him in the induction today and, you know, seeing the numbers and everything that he put up, is we're just not going to see pitchers like CeCe anymore. I mean, that era is over. That kind of pitcher is done. They're just conditioned now, you know, to go five or six innings, you know, on some nights go longer. But that's just the way the game is programmed now. And that's the way these starting pitchers are programmed.
When, you know, so that was 2008 and legendary put the team on his back with Milwaukee. Then the Yankees, Brian Cashman makes him the offer, the Godfather offer he can't refuse, gets him to the Yankees in that offseason with Burnett, with Teixeira. What did CeCe Sabathia, in your recollection, what did he bring to that clubhouse?
Well, just to add on to what you said about when Cashman got him, you know, and I think CeCe's repeated it since, is that he had no intention, you know, of coming east and playing for the Yankees until, in Cashman's words, he hit him over the head with a big bag of cash, and that changed his mind. So, I mean, he wasn't driven to become a Yankee or to have like a Gerrit Cole, you know, to come here and do what he did, and yet, you know, he understood what it meant when he came here. Like, he didn't just come here for the money. You know, he came here, you know, he was being paid all that money to come here. He was just going to be CeCe Sabathia. And that was the kind of respect that he commanded once he got here. Despite being new, he just had this, I guess the term you would use these days is the aura that he had about him. And he was respected for just kind of the bulldog and, you know, guy that just wouldn't turn the ball over, you know, that he just wanted to stay in the game until the end. And that's what really commanded the most respect. I mean, he was always a fun-loving guy. He was always a very popular clubhouse guy. But I think the bottom line was every fifth day, he took those starts extremely seriously. You know, you could see him on the mound. There was no joking around on his day to pitch. And I think that's what really earned the respect quickly in coming to the Yankees, who already had, you know, a number of established people here. They did import the names that you mentioned for that World Series run. But CeCe really, you know, kind of had to make himself part of that. And he was just somebody that kind of earned respect, like, right away.
My recollection was that there was a mentoring of Andy Pettit to CeCe Sabathia, that Sabathia then paid it forward and passed it on. What was your recollection of that leadership and mentoring chain within the Yankees from that core four legendary team? Then we go to 2009 and CeCe, and then after that.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, with Pettit and CeCe, it was a lefty thing. You know, there was always that camaraderie among left-handers, and certainly guys that took the mantle of being a frontline starter. So I think we always had that sort of legacy with the Yankees when it was passed down from generation to generation. And the Yankees were fortunate enough during their dynastic years that they really had, you know, the core four, and it was really easy to kind of carry on that tradition. So, I mean, they did bring in the hired guns, you know, the Clemens types and the Wells and those kind of guys, but you always had the people that kind of passed the torch to the next generation, and that's how, you know, you mentioned CeCe and carrying that, you know, getting that from Pettit. You know, that was the same way with him. You know, he understood at that point, like I mentioned, he didn't have it in his heart to be a Yankee his entire career, but he adopted it, understood what it meant, and understood what it meant in passing that legacy along, you know, to the next generation there. And I think he did a good job of that. I mean, I think towards the latter ends, like I mentioned, he couldn't be the same guy because, you know, age catches up to all of us. But I think mentally and for what it meant to be a Yankee, he really kind of embraced that. And he became one of the torchbearers, just as Derek Jeter was before him. He carried it on after that.
Is there a CC story from that time period that stands out to you, whether it was something about his performance with the Yankees or something in the clubhouse or with the media or taking a young player under his wing, anything that kind of stands out to you?
Well, I mean, I think some of the stuff and people, this is stuff that people had seen, was just the kind of fact that he really embraced the kind of enforcer role on the mound. Mm-hmm. I mean, we remember the brawls that he was a part of. We remember him getting ejected down at Tropicana Field that day for getting, you know, getting revenge. And what people, you know, I don't know if many people recall that, is, but when he was ejected, it left him two innings short of his $500,000 bonus for that year. And, you know, believe me, he knew what those numbers were coming up, and it didn't matter to him. You know, that he felt above all, it was about defending his turf, defending the Yankees, and defending what they were trying to do against, you know, what he felt was disrespect on the Rays' part. So I really feel it's things like that. I mean, I don't have a specific anecdote from, like, clubhouse-wise that I can recall, but I just remember the way that we talked about, the way he carried himself and how important, you know, being part of the Yankees was to him. You know, I think you saw that today with the induction as well. And I think to see him evolve from being that free agent, the Bay Area guy, and being lured to the Yankees from Cashman just because, you know, they wanted to get back to the glory years again. And that's what CC was able to do, restore them back to the glory years. And that's something they've been chasing, you know, unfortunately for them ever since.
2009, with CC Sabathia, the Yankees win the World Series, their last World Series title. And then in 2015, he has the very public, you know, battling alcoholism, going into rehab. And I think that's also an interesting, you know, showing that the flaws in the humanity and the recovery, to me, that's also an interesting part of his story that is a little different as well, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, I think I was on that trip in Baltimore when that first came out. And I think that was the point where, and I think CC has come out and admitted this since, that he kind of, you know, he kind of hit rock bottom with it. You know, that's when he was really kind of out of control with it and had to kind of grab the reins. And it was a very confusing time because I think he may have been scratched from a start or something had happened. I remember being down in Camden Yards during that point. And that's when that all came out. And yeah, that was a very human side to it. You know, you mentioned how we look at these guys as, you know, kind of like superheroes, you know, on the field, and what they're able to accomplish from a day-to-day basis, and how they, you know, have to be perfect many times in fans' eyes. But in this case, you know, CC, who's, you know, he's a Hall of Fame pitcher, you know, one of the greatest ever pitch for the Yankees and the World Series winner. And he was as vulnerable as anybody else to things that can overtake you. So, yeah, I think it was, you know, not many people were aware of it at the time and until it did eventually come out, something that he admitted to. So, yeah, I think that was a very human side to his story. And, you know, whenever those things kind of come out, they wind up being helpful to a lot of other people, too, who can have similar problems. And, you know, when they can see, you know, people that they, you know, admire to have the same kind of struggles, I think it really resonates with a lot of people that are going through the same stuff.
Yeah, a member, certainly a role model in a lot of ways, and, you know, just a crazy you know, a member of the 3,000 strikeout club, and just a you know, a career that certainly, you know, now a Hall of Famer, and yeah, somebody who made a huge impact on baseball in our area. Talking to Dave Lennon from Newsday about the Hall of Fame, the induction ceremony today. Ichiro. So
right.
Ichiro, you know, I find it, you know, it's so interesting when you see those three guys standing there on stage and you see
very different looking people.
Yes. And you see that, you know, I mean, when CeCe is slimmed down, but even still, CeCe was right. A man mountain when he pitched. And,
oh, for sure.
And there's Ichiro, who is, I mean, he looks slight, not just in terms of, like,
I mean, he said today he was 5'11". I don't know about that. I've stood next to him many, many times, and I'm 5'8", and he wasn't towering over me with an extra 3 inches there, I don't think so. That might have been an exaggeration on Ichiro's part.
Right, so he doesn't look 5'11", and, you know, and just, he has a slight build, and yet here mm-hmm. was, you know, well, let's start with, what's the historical significance of this player, the first Japanese position player and the first Japanese player in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, what it did first and foremost was establish Japanese players as effective position players, because before Ichiro, all we had seen was pitchers.
Yep.
You know, we hadn't seen a Japanese player come over here and, you know, not just survive in the major leagues, but we had never seen anything like Ichiro. I mean, I remember Bobby Valentine had always talked about him as somebody who was familiar with Japanese baseball and had tried to get him to the Mets. Famously, they couldn't do it. They didn't wind up putting up the money for it, which they've come to regret, obviously, during that time. But Bobby Valentine was a big proponent of that. But you know, like any player from Japan, you always hear about the hype, you know, because they've become, you know, legends playing in Japan. You know, they have the high school legends of them as school kids growing up, and the amazing feats they've done, then what they've done for the Japanese league. You know, nobody ever seen a player like them. We've never seen the bat to ball skills, never seen the speed, we've never seen the arm, all that stuff. But it's always kind of taken with a grain of salt, because everybody's like, oh, it's, you know, it's in the Japanese professional league, how is that going to transfer to the majors? Well, when Ichiro showed up, I mean, people's minds were blown. I mean, here's a guy that was beyond what his billing was. That people just didn't think that was possible. So to see him do what he did for the Mariners and burst on the scene like he did, I think that really imprinted in everybody's mind that, wow, you know, this is possible. This is possible to have the next great Japanese stars come here. And it was really Ichiro that kind of paved the way in this very kind of unique skill set. You know, he was a right fielder, but wasn't the typical right fielder in the sense that he wasn't a big power guy.
No, he looked like a second baseman.
right. Just an incredibly fast, smart, you know, incredibly intelligent player, but with good physical skills, speed, great arm, and incredible bat-to-ball skills. And, you know, that's just an incredible worker, too, and made the most out of every, let's say, you know, 5'9" inch of his frame. So, but, I mean, I think Ichiro, plain and simple, you know, we talked about CeCe being, you know, an incredible pitcher and a workhorse and somebody from a bygone era, really a throwback pitcher. Ichiro was a phenomenon. I mean, he was just something that we hadn't really seen when he hit the major leagues. And I think that was really what captured everybody's imagination, just to watch him and how he went about his business was really something to behold.
How did he go about, you know, you say, just even whether it was watching him practice or prepare, or the you know, he talked today about the details and the little things. Was it something that you could watch, that you were watching a technician when you watched him prepare for a baseball game?
Yeah, I mean, everything that he did was down to the details of the number of swings, with the number of steps he took to get places. I mean, it was a very orchestrated thing. And I think the thing that struck me, and it was kind of famously, and he was one of the first guys to do this, is that he used Mizuno bath, a Japanese company, obviously. Mm-hmm. But he took such care and craftsmanship with his bath that he carried them around in a specially made case by Mizuno that monitored the humidity levels. It was basically a traveling humidor that he kept his baths in, that he always kept by his locker home and road. It had a little humidifier in it so you could tell the moisture level of the bath. And that's how specific he was to it. So I just remember that case being around all the time because it was so unique. But I mean, that's how seriously he took hitting. You know, I don't even know how to explain it. I mean, guys now are much more, I think that the evolution of bats now has come so far and guys are so specific with it that that's carried on a bit, but not to the sense that they carried him around in humidors, essentially, like Ichiro did. But those are the kind of things that he thought of. You know, he was always mindful of which way the wind was blowing.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.
He was in the outfield. He just couldn't have enough information come game time. And I thought that was really a special thing to see when you were around him in the clubhouse.
There's a meticulousness about him.
Sure.
That just seems to be different than others. So I remember, obviously, Bobby Valentine had worked in Japan and therefore, yeah, was a big advocate of Japanese baseball, had a lot of information and knowledge about some of the players over there. I don't recall. So are you saying that the Mets refused to put up the posting fee for Ichiro, and that had they done that, I always assumed that Ichiro wanted to stay out on the West Coast. He ended up going with Seattle. But like, are you saying that the Mets could have been the team that was selected?
Oh yeah, that's not a new story. Not all these years later, that's not breaking news with it. Bobby did push for the Mets to get involved with it, and they didn't. I don't think they bought into the Ichiro phenomenon as Bobby was pushing them for it. So yeah, I mean, the Mets could have had a chance of getting Ichiro. So it just didn't, you know, the Mariners wound up being the ones that went all in on it. And they're the ones that wound up getting him. So it would have been interesting to see how history might have been changed if Ichiro wound up in Flushing. That's for sure.
Sort of feels like, at least at the time, that somehow, yeah, the Mets would have, I don't know, he would have ended up, I don't know, blowing out a hamstring.
Not in Cooperstown.
Something would have happened.
Well, I will say the Kaz Matsui was a very hyped player as well.
I do remember that. I remember Kaz Matsui.
When they got him, and that probably didn't work out as well as anyone had imagined. But so, yeah, I mean, yeah. Things can go different ways. You know, nothing is guaranteed. But, you know, another thing I'll bring up about Ichiro, which I thought was funny, and I think people got a taste of today, you know, the fact he did a speech in English today, because, you know, he used an interpreter, you know, throughout his time here, which, you know, is understandable, because a lot of guys, whether you're Spanish speaking or Japanese speaking or whatever it may be, you know, guys do feel more comfortable, you know, on TV or, you know, being quoted, you know, having maybe a better grasp. But he did speak English fine with his teammates. And the other thing about it was that people said today that they didn't realize he was so funny. And that's something that people did realize that were around him, because he was a very fun-loving guy with teammates and loved to joke around quite a bit. And, you know, I don't have any stories about him giving people hot flips or anything like that, but that was something that people said about him a lot, that he was a very fun teammate to have. And he was always, I mean, all the times that I remember him, he was pretty much laughing and joking with the other guys he was playing with, because I think part of it is just how much he loved the game. You know, even now, he's kind of a, I don't even know if you'd call it consultant, really, with the Mariners, but he just shows up. You know, he'll show up, put on a uniform, go head out into the outfield, you know, take some fly balls, pitch batting practice. So, you know, I think he's just going to be doing that for the rest of his life. You know, the Mariners will be somewhere, or they'll be in spring training in Arizona, and he'll just show up with a suitcase, put on a uniform, and go run out to the field. So it's pretty funny that we can still have, you know, characters like that in this day and age, when we tend to take sports really at every level, you know, pretty seriously.
Talking to Dave Lennon about the Hall of Fame and the third player and from our area and the impact today, Billy Wagner. And again, there's CeCe all of 6'5". There's Billy Wagner, as he said, 5'10". And how incredible, again, things that we're not likely, to see again, maybe ever, but someone who breaks their arm at 10 years old, a natural right-hander, and then they go into the Hall of Fame as a lefty.
I mean, if you, you just can't really think, I mean, listen, Cooperstown, the Hall of Fame, has inspirational stories in every corner you look in that building. So I wouldn't say that Billy's special in that regard, but in the way that he did it, I think there is some uniqueness to that. You know, like he said, he wouldn't recommend that as a course to get to Cooperstown, you know, breaking one of your arms and learning to throw with the other one. But it worked for him. So I think it's just, you know, I think Billy Wagner's whole story is just an incredible story of perseverance and heart and guts and just a drive to do what he did. I mean, for a guy his size, you know, at a time where, you know, a lot of closers, I mean, he was, you know, people were like deathly afraid of facing that guy. You know, a lefty that threw as hard as he did during that time. I mean, people, you know, now every closer throws 100 or whatever, or cranks it up pretty close to that. But Wagner was kind of a special case back then. And just with his attitude and his size and the lefty delivering the ball as he did, you know, it was just kind of a freak's not the right word for it. I just think it was such a scale.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you have a podcast and want to monetize it, stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.